get to introduce it. Okay. And actually, you guys can still read this.
We'd like you to perform it.
He's a sound and radio artist who divides her time between Toronto and Montreal. And then I'm supposed to skip to say that she performs internationally all over the place. And then I'm supposed to say Anna is a free 103.94.org transmission artist, frequent contributor to ORF. Now, make sure I pronounce this right. Conf Radio, Austria. She is also a founding member of the Toronto-based research collective LOT Experiments and Urban Research.
Back. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for showing up bright and early. And I promise to make noise and keep you alive here. I'm a PhD student in the Communication and Culture program up at York University, and I've also been a professional sound and radio artist for the last 15 years or so. And so my work involves performing radio specifically, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. And I should say that radio art is kind of an obscure category. We are a fairly small tribe in the world who work in this way. But within that, there is also a lot of allegiances to people working in media art and other forms of transmission, including works with television and different sorts of wireless systems. So,
I'm so sorry. That's precisely what I was trying to avoid.
So this is the place from which my work stems, and I feel like a kind of happy newcomer to performance studies because I've spent most of my time in communications fields and feminist media studies. So my artistic practice also draws directly on disciplines such as soundscape, recording and composition, also audio art, experimental music, and I do a lot of work now for theater and dance performers, in particular people who want me to create different sorts of analog and radiophonic environments in which performance can take place. So I'm not going to be talking about that so much today, but that is definitely something that is part of my practice. Radio in particular allows me to reflect on persistent questions about human communication, phenomenologies of wirelessness, particularly the mediated experience of distance and time, and relationships of sociality and technology. So today what I want to talk about is particularly these ideas of transmission as craft, and also my mobile and micro radio installations and performances. I want to emphasize that I don't work with radio as a trailing edge medium because I have nostalgia for the past or I want to reclaim the golden age of radio. To the contrary, I work with radio because to me it's still a very invigorating, complex terrain in which to ask questions about communications and electronic media. And in fact, the fact that it's no longer new or hip or cool really allows for something new to be possible. Like, it doesn't bear any of the weight of being avant-garde anymore, which is ironically why you can do really a lot of things with radio now. So before I kind of get to the point of my presentation, because on this panel we're discussing research creation, and this is the method that I employ in my dissertation work and also have used in other academic research pursuits. I want to sort of ground my discussion in the discipline in which I'm coming from. And so, in particular, that would be media studies. Also, my theoretical questions stem from debates within communication theory, media studies, and science and technology studies. So, my program likes to call this collectively technology in practice. And so that's basically what I'm doing. Making radio art amidst social scientists occasions many justifications for the rigor of such a working method as research creation. Media art, particularly new media art, also carries particular pitfalls in its language and its method uses. So, for instance, the description of research outcomes in the terms of deliverables and the tendency to formulate more corporately influenced or uncritical research problematics. And I can certainly speak to a number of projects that I feel have been plagued with some of these problems. So my work is called, the working title is The Dream Life of Radio. I don't think that's going to stick, actually, but it sounded nice. And it really springs from a particular set of circumstances within critical theories of technology. And so I'm going to just take a couple moments just to describe what that is. A pressing question in media studies is how the possibility of a medium arises, as well as how its material form comes to be. And it's most often addressed through very meticulously constructed and contextualized case studies. A constructivist approach proposes that technologies are not discovered, but designed at a particular historical juncture in response to particular socio-political circumstances. This may seem really obvious, but when you look at the history of media art, very often it's discussed in sort of laudatory terms as though the medium were like, oh, you know, resources to be discovered, and we're going to utterly transform all of human consciousness. So feminist scholars such as Lisa Gittleman also emphasize the unpredictable role of the user in driving technological development, particularly as socially subordinated users such as women in the 19th century exercise agency and affect the cultural form of an emerging medium to a degree that the designers and economists did not or could not imagine. So her study, for instance, discusses how the phonograph was, like the use of the phonograph was really influenced by women who were more or less stuck at home in the parlor who wanted to be able to listen to music and have kind of a concert setting. A critical theory of technology, as proposed by scholars such as Andrew Feinberg and Darren Barney, argues that constructivists potentially produce analyses that are so specific to cultural and historical context as to render more general ethical discussions about technology impossible, and that there is too much focus on creation and acceptance of new technologies and not enough attention to the social impact or the brute facts of objects and devices. A critical theory of technology explores four aspects, therefore: the essence, the design, the situation, and the use. That is to say, it undertakes both ontological and empirical forms of analysis. Now, speaking of essences is always a very dangerous thing to do when you're talking about technology, but I think in this case what they're really trying to do is to straddle a few different approaches, and certainly drawing from people such as Heidegger and saying that technology certainly does shape thought, but humans have also designed technologies. So there's a kind of push and pull between what you might call instrumentalization as well as a sense of inframing. Technology is not inherently provocative of positive or negative change, but nor is it neutral. Technology is embedded in changing social relations, but there's also something about technology, particularly emerging informatics, that enable new forms of being. And these are, of course, influenced by the imperatives of power and economics that surround the development of these. Now, my own work around wirelessness and transmission has been strongly shaped by this approach, and particularly the feminist scholar Judy Wachman's proposal of the embodied self as material, relational, and always already embedded within socio-technical networks, while attending to the economies and relations of power at work in such networks. Now, radio is particularly, I find, a very good example of this, simply because it's a technology that very early on was had a lot of possibility to go in different directions, but was really shaped by the imperatives of licensing and by the military. So by the end of World War I, radio had really been pushed into certain forms and continued to mainly follow the broadcast model that we know today. So with that under control, my research has therefore been a kind of ontological and phenomenological, and to some small degree an empirical study of radio, highlighting themes of transception, embodiment, resonance, and this very strangely intimate distance of radiophony. So I will talk about those things in a moment briefly, but that's kind of the setting from which my research began, is very much wanting to ground the work in a particular approach to understanding technology. So a few words about research creation. It's a word that's kicking around a lot these days. As part of the work I'm submitting for my candidacy in the next year, is I'm submitting three recent multi-channel radio works that are both useful for installation and performance. We're seeing an example of one here that I will also talk about in a moment. This was hung at Nuit Blanche in Toronto here last fall, and it involves 250 radios suspended from the ceiling of a bank building, the lobby of the Scotiabank building in downtown Toronto. And they are set to two different frequencies in this particular array, so that is to say that the radios are receiving a broadcast from my transmitters, and there's a pattern, an interlocking pattern of the two transmissions, so that there's a quite dynamic panning between the elements. And the room is actually very dark, so like we just turned some lights on for the photographs, but people's experience of it was a very dark room with very small little LED bike lights, so hanging over the radios, and they were suspended just above people's heads, like you could reach up and touch them. So that's when I talk about a multi-channel radio array. That's one of the versions of what that looks like. Now, so part of my work is I'm going to be submitting a series of artworks, but then there's also the opportunity to write about what this research has been. And so my approach to research creation is very much a kind of reflective series of feedback loops in terms of beginning from a point of inquiry and curiosity, proceeding to begin to make some work. This usually generates some very specific problematics. I make more work. I do a lot of reading on the side. I show the work. I have some more thoughts. I retweak. I do different iterations of the work. So this installation is called Respire, and it's actually the sister piece of another one called You Are Far From Us. And over a five-year period, I've done, I guess, about six different iterations of these two multi-channel radio arrays that are closely related. And that's really part of the research creation process in order to continue honing and refining and testing certain ideas. And in particular, the thing that I was interested in with these works was to consider how the body might seep back into a wireless system where the body was not visible, but make it audible. And also through choices of circuit and minor media, performance strategies, and compositional elements to examine the potential of such an aesthetic work to activate listening and affect, and in particular empathy and a kind of reverie. I'm interested in process-focused, reflective, and reflexive inquiry, as I said. So reflective in the sense of developing theory that is embedded in practice, and reflexive in the sense of acknowledging experience and social history as the context in which research and creation are formulated, and that these can be employed together with more traditional research strategies. In my case, I also am doing literary analysis and then writing more about critical theories of technology as well. So my process differs from other models of research creation by undertaking the art making as a step in the research phase and as a sort of continuous feedback loop. So you might call that creation as research, which is spawned from research-led practice and is followed by writing and further theoretical questioning. And I should say that, as an aside, I'm working with some other scholars at Concordia to try to hammer down some different categories of research creation in order to better be able to assess the rigor of projects that are produced, because research creation projects often get sort of pushed together in one pile, and the processes by which they operate are really very different, and it can range from research that is then later presented creatively to research that feeds creation to creation that feeds different forms of research and writing. So the place of where the making comes in and what role it has can be very different according to different projects, and they really shouldn't be assessed in the same pile, it seems to me. They all sort of have their own criteria. I'm really against any kind of proof of concept. I'm very allergic to this idea, and in media art, this is a really big problem at the moment, particularly from funding bodies that really like this language of deliverables. And the kind of work I do is really not about deliverables. I'm not developing a new platform. I'm not creating a new piece of software. I'm very much interested in the experimentation process. I very much want to contribute to theoretical debates that are happening in communication theory. And particularly because I study media, I want to think radio by making radio. So I really try to avoid those kinds of what seem to me to be very sort of corporate-influenced language forms. The guiding paradigms to the processes of creation of new works for me were transception, embodiment, empathy, and resonance. And my process along the way has also included, as I mentioned, literary analysis and a kind of empirical research. And I will say my empirical research has been a little weird. It involves staying up at night at specific times to listen to shortwave and to listen basically to interfrequency sounds within shortwave. So I've spent about a year just kind of doing this recording and mental mapping system of different sorts of sounds that are heard on shortwave. And so I'm going to play you a little bit of something that I found, because it'll give you a sense of the weird world of radiophony. One of the ideas that I was sort of struggling against in communication theory is the idea of the spectrum as being a kind of flat map of the electromagnetic world. So you have these different bands where you can divide AM and FM, and there's microwave, and there's cell towers, and there's X-rays, and, you know, there they all are laid out. But in reality, the spectrum is a totally messy place, and you realize that the idea of a spectrum is a purely discursive form that was put together in part to allow the state to be able to better parcel off these portions. In effect, often what I hear when I listen to shortwave late at night is, because I play around with making different antennas so I can receive other sorts of signals, and big rolls of copper wire and big spools, and like now I have an old ham radio antenna sitting in the back of the house that I rent, so I ran a bunch of copper wire up to the top and just about killed myself putting it up there. Anyway, I started picking up stuff like this. What this is, nobody knows. I'm pretty sure now that I've figured out that it's packet radio exchange going on higher frequencies in shortwave, but it shouldn't have been where I heard it. And discussing this with a couple of other radio engineers, what I understand is that, in fact, the way that radio frequencies function is that you have a lot of sympathetic frequencies. So something of that's a pretty fairly strong signal can actually kind of fold down, like an echo of it can fold down into lower frequencies if there are sympathetic frequencies. And this is what I discover a lot when I'm listening to different forms of radiophonic activity. Also, I make very small little copper coils that I can pick up the electrical fields from different kinds of devices around town. And I mean, if we weren't in the city, presumably I'd be able to hear ionospheric activity, but there's simply too much electrical magnetic activity in the city to be able to hear that. But anyway, this is another part of the practice too. It's also called a VLF field recording. So these kinds of things are part of what I consider my so-called empirical research. Also, I spent quite a bit of time discussing what I'm listening to. As I say, I have a couple of radio engineering friends who I keep sending little snippets of things to and saying, what's this? And I heard this. And how does this work? And then also beginning to learn more about, from the kind of ham radio crowd, about things like forward scatter from meteorite showers and just like a very, very interesting particular phenomena. So this has really formed part of what helps me understand this environment, this radiophonic environment in which my research takes place. And it's also a very phenomenological experience too, because you spend all this time with your headphones on listening to different forms of static and kind of perceiving that it's not this flat environment, but it's the environment with a lot of depth. In terms of, just briefly, the sort of literary work that I'm doing, part of the history of radio art at the moment is that there's kind of a genealogy in retrospect being constructed by different media art historians. And there's to my mind, a kind of undue focus on the futurists and the manifestos of the futurists and early modernists that have a very particular approach to technology and to communication, and also to ideas about women and race and so on. And so I find it disturbing that a lot of these manifestos have reappeared in people's works and online in a very uncritical form. And as a point of kind of a point of interest, I thought, what if we were to choose a different modernist and depart from there? And so I was interested in your work, Laura, because I found Gertrude Stein is somebody who has a lot to say for the radio art world, it seems to me. Not because she did that much radio in her life, but more because her sense of presence and time is very interesting as a place of departure, as opposed to the sort of speed-obsessed futurists. So part of my work eventually will be to incorporate this kind of thought experiment of what if Gertrude Stein was a kind of progenitor for ideas about radio? What if we departed from her form of modernism instead of the futurist form? Mm-hmm. So that's more of an aside, really.
Basically, there's 2 minutes.
All right. Okay. So the ideas that I, as I mentioned, that I'm interested in terms of transception, they're my most intensive thoughts were with regard to the tension between dialogue and broadcast that occurs in communication theory, and transception championed by Brecht in the 30s and then, you know, continuing on to today. Transception is an idea that proposes a more nuanced version of sending and receiving, whereby people may operate both as senders and receivers, but not simply in like a walkie-talkie form, but more in a kind of complex circuit of community self-awareness, using radiophony as one of the elements. So the kind of work I do with micro-radio is very much about trying to create the transceptive environments in which for the works to occur within. A particular interest to me is this idea of moving away from radiation and into resonance as a key paradigm for transmission. And so whether centrifugal or centripetal, the radial imagination always proposes a center and a margin with all the attendant tensions and power play that such duality engenders. Radiation, however, becomes emblematic of and a risky byproduct of systems of command and control, a concern particularly taken up by spectral ecologists. So resonance, as a different paradigm, directs awareness to an experience of co-presence within an immersive situation in which vibrations take place, whether that be the literal physical environment of transmission or resonance within the cultural imaginary. So again, I'm trying to subvert certain kinds of radio paradigms that I believe are not natural, but are just, you know, a form of a series of historical and economic and political choices. And by trying to reframe radio as this resonant medium, it leads me to create works that are more in the line of this sort of activity. And then finally, as I say, I'm really interested in trying to push elements of the body back into wirelessness, because another common, to my mind, misconception within media studies and radio art in particular is the idea that radio is naturally disembodied. And I have a real problem with that, because radio is all about these complex vectors of different sorts of bodies, whether they be devices or humans, and just your presence in the room has made my small transmitter and my radios respond to you, and, like, you know, I sort of retune as people walk in. And with these little guys, they're very cheap, and when you have so many of them in the same room, they also transmit to one another. They're extremely sensitive to people walking around, so they give off little bursts of interference, and they end up becoming these collaborator performers. So for me, it's a very physical, very embodied environment, and I'm really interested in how to hear bodies that are distant and invisible still through through the medium. So I'm going to play a couple of small things to end off here. These were also beginning points of the research. I recorded this while I was walking around with walkie-talkies, and I picked up somebody's cordless phone conversation. This is someone waiting to leave a message on the telephone. So I'm really interested in these traces that you can hear transmitted that are usually eliminated from traditional radio broadcasting, like the sounds of gasps and intakes of breath and rustling around and undue bits of emotion. So the last bit I'm going to play are two pieces from when I used to work at a community radio station, and we were doing live broadcasts from various protests. This one. So I'm interested in these ways that the voices break and fall apart, and that you can really hear something physical about the location, and suddenly very much is transmitted from someplace far away. And sort of in closing, for me, that it's not that that radio overcomes distance or overcomes time. It's rather the fact that we hear distance and we hear time, like we hear people who are far away, and that this is really a strong mortal moment, and that the fact that we can feel something for someone who is with so little information is to me a really, it's really very much at the scale of the human that I find fascinating. So that's all I'll say for now, and perhaps in the question period if there are more details you want to
come with. Thank you.
Happy to talk.
I have a few, just a few pictures, so all our slides. Anyway,
so shall I introduce you while you...
Sure, equally concisely.
All right. So it's my pleasure to introduce Bruce Barton, who also invited me to join this panel. Bruce is a playmaker and a scholar. He teaches devising, dramaturgy, and intermedial performance at the University of Toronto. He has published in numerous scholarly and practical periodicals, which I will not list now, but which are impressive, I assure you. Also, current research includes a 3-year study on dramaturgies of the body in physically-based devised theater and intermedial performance. Current creative practice includes writing and dramaturgy for multiple devised theater projects and the creation of an aerial-based interdisciplinary performance, which I can also assure you is an excellent work.
Am I actually might? Because I don't need to be.
Nope.
Can I just push those away?
Yeah,
great. So I should begin by pointing out that although this session is entitled Research-Based Practice, Peel and I invited Anna to present with us basically because we were really excited about her work as an artist and as a scholar. But her connection to the ideas that I'm going to talk about under the rubric of Research-Based Practice, which come from some of our work in the Association or the American Society rather for Theater Research, and then it was published in an article that some of you may have seen in TDR, not the last issue, but the issue before that. Anna's connection with those ideas are largely coincidental, so she shouldn't be asked to explain or defend our ideas. Paper is called How the Doing is Done, and I'll begin by saying that for our parts, Peebles and mine, the resort to the phrase research-based practice is, we hope, more than a whimsical word game. Rather, it's a gesture that makes explicit key elements of the still-emerging PBR project, practice-based research model, that we're beginning to explore. Research-based practice emerged out of our ongoing exchange with the research group on theater studies and cognitive science at ASTR, and with the study circle on practice-based research of the Nordic Summer University in Scandinavia. Particularly in the latter of these two contexts, the primary objective was the identification of practice-based research models that allowed a diverse group of participants from both research and artistic backgrounds to collaboratively explore a mutually agreed-upon and mutually beneficial set of concerns. In pursuit of an approach that respects and reflects a broad range of training, skill sets, institutional contexts, and personal interests, Peel and I arrived at a model that involves 3 separate spheres of activity, each governed by a different set of practices and priorities. One sphere, here, focuses on training and skills acquisition and refinement. The activities in this sphere are governed by carefully selected and rigorously applied artistic approaches. A second sphere focuses on empirical experimentation. Correspondingly, the activities in that sphere are governed by carefully selected and rigorously applied research methodologies. A third sphere, what we refer to as the third space of research-based practice, is in fact the initial area of activity. In this sphere, the selected inputs, the questions and ideas drawn from a cross-paradigm perspective of participating in the research are brought into quite unconventional and spontaneous interaction in order to explore possible connections and applications. These unformed and tentative connections and contaminations are then transferred to the more rigorously structured and maintained first and second sphere. There they're subjected to more stable and more controlled inquiry using appropriate artistic approaches or research methodologies, respectively. The process is then repeated, with the results generated in these paradigm-specific spheres carried back into the third space for additional exploration. And in turn, this exploration is then reintroduced into the outer spheres for for yet another round of experimentation and development, for further utilizing the most recent contamination across the paradigms. In one sense, then, the RBP design is continuous and self-serving, an ongoing process of internal contamination, modification, and refinement. However, it's also directly connected to the outside world in multiple ways. The space of training and artistic skills acquisition yields immediately applicable benefits for performance generation and production, which it is directly associated with through shared artistic approaches. The sphere of empirical experimentation similarly yields immediately applicable benefits for more traditional approaches to research, both performance research and research in other fields, with which it is directly associated through shared research methodologies. And the third space of exploration yields multiple benefits for other research-based practice and more broadly practice-based research projects through the ongoing refinement of strategies for the exploration and the documentation of interdisciplinary and inter-paradigm research contexts. In fact, a key outcome of this third space of activity is the ability to ask increasingly complex and innovative questions in other RBP projects. So the remainder of my presentation today focuses on a new research project that is in the very early stages of completion. As with her own project that Pila's going to talk about, mine represents an incomplete embrace of this research-based practice model. But in drawing on this potential future when designing our individual projects, both Pila and I are gaining experience with and testing parts of this overall model. My project is called How the Doing is Done, Canadian Physical Theatre and Interactual Dramaturgy. And it's funded through the Standard Research Grant Program of the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. The title incorporates a quotation from Eugenio Barro. "It is the doing and how the doing is done which determine what one expresses." The objectives of this program of research are threefold. First, to provide an historical and contemporary survey of physically based theatre in Canada. Second, to articulate an original theoretical perspective for the dramaturgical analysis of physically based theatre across diverse training and creative processes. And three, to establish a conceptual vocabulary for cross-process exchange and collaboration among physically based theatre practitioners in Canada and beyond. Now, physically based theatrical devising has never been more popular nor more variously represented within Canada than at the present moment. Less than a decade ago, the term devising was quite uncommon among practitioners and indeed many scholars of performance in this nation. Today, there are numerous dedicated streams within a broad range of post-secondary educational institutions, York University being one of these, University of Alberta, Humber College, the National Theatre School. Not to mention a plethora of professional and non-professional training programs. High-profile, self-identifying devising companies operate in every province and represent an increasingly significant element in Canada's international theatre profile. However, the relative brevity of the rise of the term devising as nearly ubiquitous is deceiving. The history of collectively and collaboratively created physically based theatre performance in Canada is significantly longer, rowdier, and more complex. It is also central to the initial and ongoing character of virtually all theatrical activity in this country. Similarly, the use of the term devising to identify such an aggregate body of distinct approaches to training, composition, and performance is inevitably reductive, even if often it is also ideologically constructive and politically adept. No focused, integrated, and theoretically informed study of this quite diverse, yet undeniably interrelated field of theatrical activity exists, and it's my hope that I will be well along the way to providing one by the end of this project. This is, however, only the preliminary benefit to be gained from the project. In addition, the proposed research sets out to generate a theoretical framework of dramaturgical analysis inspired by and tailored to the particular cross-paradigm characteristics of theatrical devising. This theoretical framework will, in turn, contribute to a practical vocabulary for artist exchange and collaboration. In my scholarly and creative work with theatrical devisers across Canada, a regular observation is the absence of, and the need for, a means of collaborative exchange across training programs, across creative processes, and across performance modes. Results of this research, therefore, stand to facilitate both scholarly engagement with creative practice and the direct application of scholarly conceptualization to creative practice. Although an overgeneralization, it's not an excessive one to suggest that the majority of developmental dramaturgy undertaken in Canada is text-based and focuses on narrative. Even much of the dramaturgical work in dance in English-speaking Canada tends to apply traditional theatrical interpretations of structure, character, and theme, often expertly and with subtlety, but equally often without sufficient attention to non-narrative elements of performance. As my own practice as a dramaturge has increasingly focused on physically based, collaborative process, this emphasis on largely dramatic concerns has inspired me to look beyond textual understandings of performance for conceptual frameworks that attend to the full spectrum of effective possibilities. In several conference papers and a number of published essays, most recently in the issue of Performance Research on Dramaturgy I've discussed the relevance and the limitations of a variety of theoretical approaches to devising, including intertextuality and performativity, as dramaturgical models for theatrical devising. However, within performance contexts that purposely attempt to complicate conventional theatrical boundaries, I believe a further shift in focus is required to shape dramaturgical strategies that foreground and exploit the paradox of intentionality and iterative affect at play in both of these concepts. What are called for, rather, are dramaturgical strategies that treat all modes of expression, including textual expression, as interwoven acts of composition, in a manner related to J.L. Austin's Speech Act, a use of words that does work, that has effect, or at least which attempts to do so. In particular, what Austin calls perlocutions are examples of speech that, quote, often, or even normally, produce certain consequential effects upon the feelings, thoughts, or actions of the audience, or of the speaker, or of other persons, unquote. As G.J. Warnock points out, for Austin, quote, whether or not I intended to produce such effects, they may be incorporated in the designation of what I did. And further, quote, the perlocutionary effect in question will very often be producible also in some completely nonverbal way. Gazing back through the dense field of subsequent reinterpretation of Austin's writings by the likes of Derrida, Butler, among others, the deceiving simplicity of Austin's far from simple argument opens up a direct route to a common conceptual ground to discuss the full range of acts, actions, and affects in devised performance. What is called for is a dramaturgy attuned to the overt interactuality of the devising context. By incorporating and extending the inevitable interplay of written intertextuality, interactuality also emphasizes the embodied multimodal performativity of physically based devising. At the same time, however, it reintroduces the notion of meaning as a negotiation between intention and interpretation. A dense field of explicit signification and implicit experience that the theatrical deviser and spectator navigate consciously, intuitively, and instinctually. So the performance research design involves a mixed method combination. First, a literature review, as comprehensive as possible, of scholarly and popular material available in English, print, video, internet-based, on theatrical devising, both in Canada and internationally. In addition to generating an historical and contemporary overview of devising literature, this base of knowledge will be used to further establish, refine, and articulate interactuality as a conceptual dramaturgy for devising. Second stage will be, and we're just finishing up the literature review at this point, so that's how early we are in the process. Second stage is the on-site observation and qualitative inquiry. I'll conduct 6 case studies focusing on physically based theatre companies from across Canada. In addition to regional representation, companies have been selected with criteria based on longevity, productivity, national profile, systematic physical orientation and training, cultural diversity, and an approach to textual movement integration with an attempt to guarantee variety across the sample. This research involves on-site observation of training, composition, and performance, combined with qualitative interviews and videotaping. The data will be analyzed to both assess the validity and utility of interactuality as a means of dramaturgical analysis and design, and to generate a set of conceptual questions and exercises to be implemented in the next stage of the research. Next stage, indeed, is a 5-day devising lab event to be hosted at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and involving participants drawn from all member companies of that city's Progress Lab. Representing many of the most active and innovative physically based devising practitioners in Canada, the Progress Lab has been responsible for the highly successful Hive events held each year since 2007. And some of you may be familiar with the Hive events, but basically it's all of the companies coming together for night after night. They do over a period of about 3 hours. They each do a very small, site-specific piece within a shared space. Initially, it was in a funeral parlor. The next year, it was in a warehouse. Last year, actually, it was done at the Olympics, and I'm not actually sure where it was held. But it was the first one I didn't get to, primarily because of the Olympics one. But it's very much a collaboration within and amongst the companies. An amazing event that happens at this point yearly. The devising lab will develop in multiple stages, and it's modeled on an earlier project that I facilitated along with Peel and several other colleagues in 2006. That earlier project, which was called the Moving Stage Lab, was an 8-day devising workshop conducted with, I was trying to remember the exact number, 24 participants? I was trying to come up with that number. North European theater and film artists as part of the Copenhagen Theater Days in Denmark. As with the Moving Stage Lab, my current project's Devising Lab will feature a 3-week online reflection component facilitated and designed by Peel to foreground related theoretical and practical considerations. Daily lab sessions will be dedicated to training, exchange, experimentation, reflection, and performance material generation. There'll be a public showcase, an on-site debrief, and ongoing online reflection and exchange. Which takes us to the last section, which will be indeed an online analysis, archive analysis and exchange forum hosted by the Graduate Center for Study of Drama, where I teach, to provide research project dissemination and a platform for ongoing national and international exchange. Now, clearly, the various stages of this project span relative objectivity and critical distance at one end, and a continuum, on one end of a continuum, and relative immediacy and direct engagement at the other. Arguably, however, none of the distinct methods listed here escapes a shared methodology, one that might broadly be defined as the experiential learning model drawn from participatory action research. Many of you will be familiar with the action research model initially proposed by Kurt Lewin back in the 1940s. Not without its critics or its limitations, Lewin's model was both questioned and championed in relation to its overtly political motivations, and its concurrent generation of both data and direct consequence. Action research has nonetheless experienced renewed popularity within ethnographic and participant observation orientations to knowledge creation, and a wide range of less deterministic experiential models have emerged in the wake of Lewin's proposals. Among the most popular and accessible is the work of David Coleman, Prioritizing concrete opportunities for application with systematic reflection, Cole's model affords movement back and forth between specific instances and generalized concepts. The result is less a linear progression or a closed circular pattern than a generative spiral. Of particular relevance, the key research product of this design takes the form of utility towards future applications, which is something that it shares with the earlier model that Peel and I proposing. However, an additional factor that both enhances and complicates the multi-stage research design of my project and the generative spiral configuration of a basic experiential learning model. There is an additional factor. And concurrent with the research activities outlined above, I am or will be working as a developmental and or production dramaturg with a number of the participating theater companies. The degree to which these collaborations provide me with a deep placement within the creative processes is that I'm examining will no doubt be invaluable to the research. Simultaneously, however, in addition to all the familiar complications of praxis participation and all the familiar hazards of self-ethnography, this dramaturgical activity represents a shift of paradigms from a predominantly research-centered orientation to one that is predominantly artistic and practice-centered. This in turn results in a sudden importation of quite different sets of priorities and processes, and thus necessitates a related shift in methodology. I believe that not merely navigating, but actually capitalizing on these distinct yet concurrent sets of priorities represents both the most significant challenge and the most significant site of potential in this research. I also would believe that attempts to ignore, deny, sidestep, or contain the tensions between the research-centered and practice-centered elements of the project are all equally doomed to failure, at the risk of undermining the research's potential benefits and utility. Yet if efforts to contain this contamination of intentions and practices are substituted with efforts to facilitate, recognize, assess, and channel this contamination, as Peel and I have proposed in the research-based practice model, then the potential emerges to turn complication and contradiction into a site of generative possibility. The incomplete embrace of RBP to be found in my current project finds me largely clustered on the left side of the proposed model. And I'm supposed to have one more version of it, but I don't, so let me see that. How easily can I get back to it? It also involves yet another level of productive contamination, that which sees experiential learning in performance, praxis, and production reintroduced into the sphere of training development and the third space of experimentation. A key strategy for channeling this contamination will be the use of an eco-quality qualitative software, a program designed to code, organize, cross-reference, and analyze a wide range of qualitative and quantitative data, including text, video, and audio. In this sense, the Invivo program serves as both a fundamental tool within the research and a metaphor for the project's baseline commitment to systematically explore as many possible forms of data exchange and interaction across knowledge and experience paradigms as possible. As I noted at the beginning of this paper, I'm in the very early days of this project. Yet from this vantage point, I feel it holds the potential to both consolidate and crack open, to clarify and contaminate, not merely my understanding of my own practice as a scholar and an artist, but possibly my understanding of understanding and my practice of practice. Thank you.
So, as you introduced each other, I think I'll just very quickly introduce myself. My name is Peel Hansen. I have a doctorate from the University of Copenhagen on the topic tabular dramaturgy and perception from 2007. I currently live here and I have a postdoctoral fellowship from SHUC at University of Toronto working on a project called Acts of Memory, which is what I'll be talking about today. I'm also a professional dramaturg of devising new circus modern dance primarily. And I've published quite widely on topics of dramaturgy, memory, and practice-based research in various places. So, not knowing is where I stand as I'm about to venture into the experimental postdoctoral research project Acts of Memory. Empowered by that position, the first half of this paper will introduce the research interests, design framework, and sources that make up the landscape in front of me. In the second half of the paper, I will share some preliminary thoughts on the challenge of choosing a point of departure that is both ethically and methodologically sound in order to help me navigate this landscape over the coming 2 years. So I'm in a very different place than you are, and at the very front end of the project, more like various years. A complicating factor is that my work crosses several disciplinary boundaries. Since 2002, I have experimented with the application to dance and theater of neurocognitive perspectives on human memory and perception. Though artists have drawn on precursors of cognitive psychology for more than a century, the intersection of cognitive science and performance studies is a new field. Spurred by vast developments in embodied cognitive theory over the last decade, the American scholar Bruce McConachie recently announced a cognitive turn in performance and field studies. There are a number of turns around these days. Contributing to this turn are McConachie's colleagues, John Ullaby and Rhonda Blair, who reflect on how the cognitive sciences can help us understand and further the actor's craft. Though these scholars share a utilitarian orientation, to my knowledge, they have not yet tested or experimented with their hypotheses in practice. The Shared Habitat Symposium on Dance and Biology here in Toronto in 2002 and Scott De La Hunter's project Choreography and Cognition Europe from 2003 are initiatives to cross-pollinate cognitive sciences and practice-based research in dance through exchange of perspectives. In Acts of Memory, I intend to take this work one step further and create local punctures in the boundaries between these methodologically rather incompatible disciplines to facilitate selective channels of integration. A couple of years ago, I entered into regular coffee exchange with the Toronto-based choreographer Amy Henderson of Public Recordings and the Vancouver-based advisor James Long of Theatre Replacement. Both artists explore autobiographical memory as subject material and in their creative processes. Because we share an interest in discovering what a cognitive approach might add to their materials and processes, Henderson and Long volunteered themselves and components of their work to both cognitive and creative experimentation within Acts of Memory. Given this setup, I'm in need of a research design that establishes useful relations between the multiple kinds of interests and exploratory methodology involved. The design of Acts of Memory draws on the right-hand side of this RVP model, as the project does not aspire to produce performance material or develop new skills, where the RVP model takes its point of departure in a set of shared concerns that arrive at in the third space in the center. Acts of Memory starts out with a more conventional relation between me, the scholar, and Henderson along the artists. And in this case, I do take a scholarly position. So this design starts out with case studies of Henderson's and Long's creative processes, along with research into related perspectives in the cognitive sciences. The objective of these case studies is to use a cognitive lens to identify data about layers of autobiographical memory that can be subjected to inductive theory generation. Selected hypotheses that this theory then relies on will be tested deductively in reductive and methodologically controlled behavioral experiments with these artists. And they know that. The result of these experiments will be transferred to the third space, in which we hope to discover whether and perhaps how these results can affect and be of use to the involved artist's creative practice and aspirations. Thus, the third space will be formed by the theory of performance and creative methodologies that these artists make use of. The last step of the research process is to revise the induced theory and disseminate our different types of results. And you can see there are four current performance projects that I'm observing now, or have been in the very recent past. Though Acts of Memory does not begin in a collective space, it is an ethical priority to establish a point of departure in shared investments. My solution to this challenge is to ground my theory generation in the creative approaches and artistic inquiries of the involved artists and involve them in the selection of the final research questions. I'll pursue this question of what that means in practice with two preliminary pilot attempts to induce theory from Henderson's work. At the time of my first coffee with Henderson, she had just started up a residency project at the Theatre Centre called 300 Tapes, which explores three actors' autobiographical archives through multiple series of analogue recording, recitation, and distortion. Among others, her collaborators are the Canadian screenwriter Bobby Theodore and sound artist Anna Fritz. Around the same time, Henderson began working on a practice-based MA at the Amsterdam School for the Arts. Her MA project investigates the possibility of non-hierarchical togetherness or unison in a dance process that does not erase the individual. In the performance product of her investigation, Relay, seven dancers recall movements from choreographies they have danced in the past, while aiming towards the creation of future shared moments of unison.
And this performance premiered at Royal Stage at the Harbourfront in April of the year. And is touring at present.
At a very early stage of these projects, I noted that an integrated connection between language and embodied memory that leads to habitual responses was both relied upon and challenged. This observation was drawing upon reflections from my work as a dramaturg of interdisciplinary processes of contamination. In the creative process of Relay, several dancers relied on verbal descriptions of the relation between body parts, bodies, and space to recall memories of movement danced in the past. These were verbal descriptions that derived from the memorization techniques used when the choreography was first learned. Gradually, the group chose to eliminate spoken language and thus possibly disconnect the embodied memory from the language involved. In 300 tapes, the spontaneous gestures of an actor auto-reciting another actor's anecdote were choreographed. This choreography was then performed while reciting other non-related stories. The result was not only the separation of gestures from the telling of a specific story, but also the montage of disassociated gestures and stories. In both cases, dancers and actors reported that they found their tasks significantly more difficult after that kind of incision had been made. A cognitive lens that can help induce theory from these observations focuses on the relation between motor and semantic memory. Among others, Edelman and Tononi, Damasio, Gillies and Lakoff, and Abib all agree that many semantic concepts derive from and continue to activate the implicit motor memory of, for instance, grasping, handling, or placing oneself in relation to something else. When this hypothesis is applied as a frame of understanding to my case studies, preliminary theoretical possibilities arise. Perhaps the relation renders it difficult to separate the physical and conceptual parts of a personal memory. Perhaps implicit processes of perception, memory, and auto-response are hindered when working simultaneously on disassociated concepts and movements. Maybe such a hindrance can lead to new types of expression. As reflected in this choice, I'm invested in diving beneath the identity construction and self-narration of autobiographical memory to probe into the more implicit layers of self that autobiographical memory depends on. Among them is what Damasio has coined the core self, which is a state of self-awareness that emerges repeatedly in response to the relation between the body and the external stimuli and triggers motor memory. According to Damasio, experiences at the level of this core self triggers, maintain, and feed the autobiographical self, which is retrieved from episodic and semantic memory. A significant methodological shift is needed to transfer components from the case studies via my theory to behavioral experiments. As I initially articulated in our TDR article, Ms. Bruce. Or an RBP, the theory that auto-responses are hindered when working on disassociated concepts and movements has to be reduced to relation of cause and effect between a manipulated independent variable, which is the disassociation of concept and movement, and a dependent variable, a specific observed type of auto-response. In a simple one-way and within subject design, I could record on video the auto responses of performers when engaging with selected associated concepts and movements. Then I could repeat the experiment with the same concepts and movements arranged in disassociated combinations in order to observe differences in auto responsive behavior. So that's a really reduced question and context that I need to control to do that kind of experiment. The theory of disassociation
comes closer to a central preoccupation of mind than the artistic questions of Henderson and Long. It is too loosely grounded in the data to reflect shared investments. Returning to the case studies, I have loaded a broad range of data, rehearsal videos, interviews, notes, into Enviro, the qualitative research software that Bruce also mentioned, in order to gradually generate concepts and relations from which I can induce theory. So that's a more thorough approach. I also return to Henderson's sources of inspiration. The Deleuzian philosophers Henderson draws on, developmental cognitive science, and the field of social cognition share a preoccupation with individuation processes. Before these schools part way, they generally agree that most components of the individual derive from the collective, and that identity is a construction that, through its repetition, offers us the illusion of a continuous self. In his paper, How Does One Recognize Structuralism, from 1972, Deleuze argued that repetition within the horizon of identity tends to exclude the differential structures that are the condition for the creative transformation of things. Henderson's creative work surrenders to a group of performers, memories, that support individual group members' autobiographical selves. Given her source of inspiration, this can be understood as a deterritorializing maneuver that challenges the frame of identity by rendering collective its content. Thus, it reverses the relation between the collective and the individual. When I recently email interviewed two dancers from Relay about their individual contributions, they answered independently that they cannot separate out their work from the collective process. This indicates that what has successfully become embodied by the collective has not been subjected to a new individuation process. Yet this surrender of individual memories to the group is not complete. In her production notes, Henderson asks why the performers in Relay would resist unison at times when it seemed within reach. The question leads her to understand that unison isn't their goal. To focus on the imminent movement towards unison, rather than the unison itself, the Relay group invented a system called futuring. And that's basically what my video would be showing. But I think the examples here and the images can do the job as well. When futuring, the group moves towards a future moment of togetherness by gradually allowing the dancers' movements, including their recalled memories, to impact each other. In her notes, Henderson states that by focusing on potential unison in the future moment, this system allows for infinite difference to exist in our shared but varied present. I wonder whether the flow of this difference is fed by a distance between the individual recall of an embodied memory that refers to something that hasn't been shared with the group and the quality of the collective embodiment that is generated once other group members begin to future your individual memory. When one of the dancers writes in her email interview that I find the past more challenging than the futuring easier than remembering, it could refer to this difference between the individuated repetition and collective creation. According to Edelman's neurobiological theory of the remembered present and reconstructed memory, all perceptions and actions in the present draw on memory, and through that cycle, memory is transformed. Drawing on DiMaggio, I can also claim that every reemergence of the core self draws on the autobiographical memory, and in that process, the autobiographical memory is transformed. From that perspective, the investment of an individual memory in a collective context will alter that memory and affect one's sense of self. Yet, if you continue to draw into the collective process individual memories that have not been invested before, an effort to keep intact a sense of autobiographical consistency and continuity may quiver and offer resistance to the desire of reaching unison, basically because you continuously return to individual memory that you invest. A response to this creative paradox, that between returning to individual memories and investing in the collective movements towards unison, can be what one of the dancers thus describes in her email interview. Because we return to the same memories, we now have memories of memories of memories, but we are never fully inhabiting, I think, the existence of this layering, because we are always meeting these memories in the future. Once the dancers of Relay are futuring the memory, within the performance framework, the quiver of autobiographical memory has been largely eliminated in a collective self-feeding. In arbitrary ways, this process mirrors the ongoing recycling of embodied cognitive memory in a singular mind that is isolated from outside stimuli, and as such does not offer the creative flow that Henderson is invested in. This desire to do away with individual memories... By recomposing them collectively, re-emerged in notes and observations of 300 tapes. The topic of discomfort that several of the 300 tapes actors return to in group discussions is not the manipulation of the personal anecdotes they invest. The issue is the repeated return to the recording of the original telling. Actors complain that that story doesn't work anymore, that details are missing. Permission to edit and re-record new versions of the stories or sample several versions together is requested several times. But when the permission is given, the actors do not achieve satisfaction. They comment that the new versions are told differently from how they would tell a friend, that the system of recitation within the performance framework has begun to influence their recording, their natural telling. Desire and paradox. These recordings are made in solitude, while the systems of recitation and manipulation transfer the recordings through other voices and bodies in a process which, not entirely unlike that of Relay, produces collective memory. While the continuous return to reminders of the individual's autobiography results in discomfort, giving into the desire to surrender fully to the collective process of adaptation does away with the creative potential of the quiver, the difference, the intimacy of separate embodied selves coming together. This possible direction of induced theory gestures towards Henderson's preoccupation when she, in her notes, asks what it means to collectively realize the potential of past experiences to repurpose these as group negotiations. In terms of testing the hypothesis of this percolating theory, I can, for example, imagine looking into the questions of how durable personal memories are when subjected to these strategies of collective memory production, and whether the independent variable of memorization techniques interfere. Perhaps that can reveal possibilities of hindering systematic recall and strengthening adaptability, or vice versa. Before I get that far, I have to meet the challenge of developing a cognitive lens that is compatible with, or at least shares points of intersection with, Henderson's theoretical foundation. Deleuzean metaphysics are not epistemologically compatible with the biological realism of the cognitive sciences. Yet I think there are routes to try out in search for connections. One possibility is to return to Henri Bergson as one of both Deleuze's and William James' primary sources. Damasio and Edelman are deeply indebted to James. Another possibility is the route of dynamic systems theory, a fairly new school of Deleuzean philosophers headed up by Brian Massamy that aims to apply Deleuze's concepts to the cognitive sciences, and tell the cognitive sciences what they should do next. Finally, there is the possibility of continuing the route I have taken here and seek my own connections. After all, both Deleuze and cognitive scientists ascribe ontological status to the possibility of becoming. I'm thinking about Deleuze's concept of virtuality as potential on the one hand, and the biological understanding of neural plasticity on the other. By grounding my theory in Henderson's work and my cognitive lens in her sources of inspiration, I have confidence that I shall arrive at theory and questions for experimentation that are fueled by our differences, reflect the shared investment and utility, and can transfer from production processes through empirical experimentation and third-space creative experience.